loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, we take a look at the Turkish election that returned President Erdogan to power with vastly expanded powers. We're going to talk about what Erdogan's plans are for Turkey and Turkey's plans for the region. And then we kick off our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. And at the end of this segment, we're going to have Chris Garafa give you your weekly technology tip.
But before we get to those two stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Defense Secretary James Mattis said on Sunday that the military will build two temporary camps at unused military bases to house as many as 25,000 children in the deportation process, a sign of increasing military support for the Trump administration's hardline immigration policy. Meanwhile, the Department of Homeland Security apparently has no idea how to reunite the children who were forcibly separated from their parents. Next, the new Italian government torpedoed a European Union summit on migration over the weekend, saying that refugees and migrants are a threat to Europe's borders and to free movement within the EU. Several countries boycotted the meeting, which was meant to shore up the position of German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and in the end, no policy decisions were made. Then, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education around the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then Defense Secretary Mattis is making his first official visit to China this week. He'll also make stops in South Korea and Japan. Much of the discussion will be about North Korea, but Mattis also has another agenda, trade with China. And finally, presidential son-in-law and Middle East peace czar Jared Kushner is in Israel today, where he harshly criticized Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. Kushner's comments appear to be an attempt to head off criticism of the as-yet-unannounced Trump Middle East peace plan, which is also already opposed by Jordan. Saudi Arabia, though, will throw its considerable weight and money behind Kushner and Israel. And in other headlines, the Supreme Court made a number of high-profile decisions today. It gave a green light to 3 out of 4 disputed congressional district maps in Texas that Democrats claimed were racially discriminatory, and it reversed a lower court decision that ruled North Carolina's map to be unconstitutionally gerrymandered. The court also announced that it was declining to take on another case involving a business discriminating against a same-sex couple. Jordan's King Abdullah was at the White House today to meet with President Trump. Abdullah's government is under intense economic pressure that has caused major protests in the country. In addition to economic matters, the war in Syria and possible negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians were on the agenda. 5 European parliamentarians from Germany, Portugal, and Spain spent the night last night on a refugee ship in the Mediterranean while negotiating with Italy and Malta to allow the ship to dock. The ship, operated by a German NGO, had already spent 5 days at sea waiting for permission and not receiving it. The politicians are pushing for docking permission within 48 hours as bad weather approaches and conditions on board worsen. In response to a loss of profits after EU tariffs, Harley-Davidson now plans to move their production of motorcycles to sell to the EU out of American factories and into international facilities. The company forecasts that the tariffs will cost $90 to $100 million annually if they don't move the production. Prior to the tariffs, in January, the company closed a domestic plant in Kansas City, Missouri. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Turkey. In a victory address, Turkish President Erdogan vowed to fight terrorist groups and to enhance the country's international stature. Erdogan won re-election on Sunday with 52.5% of the vote. More importantly, though, the country has moved from a parliamentary democracy to one with an executive presidency, and the position of prime minister has been abolished. Many international observers are concerned that there is now too much power in the hands of one man in Turkey. We're joined from Istanbul by Nevzat Evrim Onal. He's a journalist with the Turkish newspaper Sol. And we are also joined from Istanbul by Max Zerngast. He's an independent journalist based in Ankara. Welcome to both of you.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Nevzat, let's start with you. You are a journalist with the Sol newspaper. What's your assessment of the election real quickly, and then we'll get Max's sense, and then we have follow-up questions for you.
Actually, I cannot say that I'm shocked at all. The only thing I want to say first is that this should be the end of all false hopes and all false solutions. We, for some time, have been saying that with this electoral process, it will be impossible to beat Erdogan in any case. So that's what happened.
Max Zerngast, impossible to beat Erdogan in the parliamentary, the existing electoral process. Is that your take?
Well, in a way, yes. I mean, but I hope we will have the chance to talk about the details of the reasons why that is the case. But for now, I mean, he won this election in a resounding win, which was one of the possibilities. It is not a complete shocker or a complete surprise, to be sure, but it was a slight hope of a different result this time, at least in some regards. That did not take place. It is a resounding victory according to the official results, which should not, there were some irregularities, but there appears to be no major fraud, let's put it this way, in the immediate electoral process. But there are, of course, irregularities and repressive system, the state of emergency and all the like. Yeah, so, I mean, in the short term, it's not on the agenda anyway. So we need to focus on what to do to build an effective counterpower in the immediate process.
I'm curious, too, as to what this means for Turkey's neighbors in the region, whether it's Syria, where, of course, there's a hot war going on, or Greece, where there's constant tension in the Aegean, even Israel. Nevzat, tell us what this means for the neighbors.
Actually, Greece's Tsipras have just congratulated Erdogan heartfully. Most probably, he is thinking that the whole tension between Greece and Turkey was due to the coming elections and will cease now because the tension was created to give internal messages to vote givers. Anyway, I think what has been 3-4 days before elections will be what will be in 3-4 days after the elections. Considering Middle Eastern neighbors, Erdogan is not aggressive towards them just because he is trying to raise his votes. That's a problematic assessment. Turkey and Turkish bourgeoisie have aspirations in Middle East, cross-border aspirations in Syria and maybe in northern Iraq. And Turkish army, for example, in Afrin, entered there not only to battle against the Syrian Kurds, but also to further the interests of Turkish bourgeoisie in the area. And this was openly stated by some government officials. So Turkish aggression towards Syria, for example, or Turkish meddling in Syria will end when the Syrian government wins the war against the Islamist uprisers and the situation settles. Until then, Turkey will play double, at least will play double in Syria, and will keep doing this because it makes money.
Max, go ahead.
Yeah, we have to see that Turkish foreign policy is not only depending on President Erdogan. For sure, as Nevzat said, I mean, there's several reasons on the engagement in other countries as of the moment, particularly in Syria and in Iraq. And a lot of that has to do also with the particular dynamics of the Middle East, with the Kurdish movement and its actions. And none of this goes away. On the contrary, what we will probably see is even the current constellation of the Turkish state that came out of this election more victorious. And even though there is no major change in the social relations, power relations, the hand of this power bloc has been strengthened, and they will probably be more aggressive towards the Kurdish movement. So this engagement will go on for sure.
Nevzat, besides a focus on the Kurds, what other domestic changes do you think we'll be seeing now that that Erdogan has won a clear majority? He has a stronger position, a stronger office, there's no prime minister. What other domestic changes do you expect?
actually, in the parliament, he does not have a clearer majority, but the parliament more or less became irrelevant with the changes. However, I think we can summarize the last 5 years of Turkey as maximum politicization with minimum organization. The side of the country, the side of the people that do not agree with Erdogan's policies, strongly disagree with his policies, were extremely political after Gezi movement, starting from Gezi movement. But this massive population, massive part of the population, did not organize. We came to this at last. The two main opposition parties, the two main social democrat opposition parties, CHP and HDP, escaped from organizing this masses into massive mobilizations for different reasons. CHP escaped from massive mobilization itself, and HDP sees the ideology of the these movements contrary to their own ideology, which is more or less national oriented. So now, in this situation, the organized side, the Islamists, being constantly, they have won like five elections until starting from Gezi movement. They have won five elections, one including the election of Erdogan himself and one referendum last year, which was much more blatantly fraudulent than this one. And being organized, having the state in their hands and being organized city by city, district by district, neighborhood by neighborhood, they are more powerful than the disorganized masses against them. So I don't think there will be massive changes in Erdogan's policies, because right now he has an important economic crisis to tackle with, but he did not lose power, more or less consolidated it again. That's what happened.
We are joined from Turkey, from Istanbul, Turkey, by Nevzat Evrem Onal and by Max Zerngast. They're talking to us about the elections held on Sunday, in which President Erdogan was reelected with a large majority, 52.5%. I'm looking at a piece, Max, in at ABC News here in the United States, and it's saying that that Erdogan's victory, of course, is being celebrated by a majority of Turks. But the thing, the unknown that's bothering people is they really don't understand the extent of these new powers, which ABC calls sweeping. Can you tell us exactly what new powers Erdogan will have now compared to what he had yesterday?
Well, to a large extent, what happened with this election is that many of the things that were already in place have now become official, so to say. The same thing happened with the referendum last year. So there was an actual rule by Erdogan as a very powerful president through the state of emergency. And then he kind of put that into law. He gave it a constitutional frame with the referendum. And now he was elected for the first time according to that new constitution that was voted on last year in the constitutional referendum. So as an immediate effect, there might not be that much of a change. But now it is legal, fully legalized, everything that he was doing up to that point. Not everything is legalized, apparently, but as far as the political process is concerned, parliament will mostly be reduced to a discussion club, so to say. However, what we should not overlook is that he has that his party, the AKP, has no absolute majority in terms of seats in parliament. It is only with the fascist MHP, the nationalist movement party, that they have the absolute majority in terms of seats of parliament. So that strengthens the hand of the MHP, because obviously, whatever the AKP and Erdogan want to do, they are depending on the MHP. And their leader, Devlet Bahçeli, already said that. He said that the MHP has now become a critical force in parliament and in Turkish politics. The crucial thing here is that Erdogan has to send, as a president, all his orders, so to say, he has to send them to parliament and they have to be accepted by parliament, which will happen, that is to be assumed. There will not be any major resistance on behalf of parliament if there is no major fallout between the AKP and the MHP. So that is the frame of what is happening right here. But I don't think that that alone determines the strength of Erdogan. So he is still not very strong. So in the West, there is the tendency, I mean, of course, he's very strong, but in the West, there is the tendency to portray him as an all-powerful ruler who can do whatever he wants. But for the last 5 years or even longer, there are largely two blocks in society that don't really change. The constellations change in elections, there are new alliances formed, and the like. But the blocks are relatively stable. That's what I meant with there is no major change in terms of social power relations. And these, the other forces, so to say, popular dynamics, the poor, workers, women, the Kurdish dynamic, the Alevi dynamic, none of these dynamics have been defeated. And I think they cannot be defeated in a major way. I mean, they can be back and forth and all that, but they cannot be defeated. And there's beyond that, structural crisis of the Turkish state and the Turkish economy. The Turkish accumulation regime that put Erdogan in the place that he is now, that was installed after the 2001 crisis, is coming towards an end. That's what it looks like. I mean, we cannot yet fully speak of an economic crisis in the technical terms, but it seems that the accumulation regime is coming to an end, and then we'll add a new crisis dynamic to an already crisis-ridden state of affairs. So we cannot speak of an all-powerful ruler that can do whatever he wants. He has to navigate a ship and has to navigate this state in a very fragile environment.
Nevzet, I want to get your opinion on that. I mean, what we've heard so much, in at least in the U.S. media, is that almost all of Erdogan's policies, his international policy, his policy towards Syria, his policies towards Russia, which have done a complete U-turn, his policies through the last few years, where the sort of fantasy of the return of the Ottoman Empire, all of that seemed to go up in smoke. At the same time, beset by domestic problems, the July 2016 coup, the terrible, very far-reaching crackdown where tens of thousands of people have lost their jobs and been imprisoned. It seemed that Erdogan is beset by so many crises and contradictions. And yet here he is with an absolute majority in the election. Does it, from your point of view, does it, as Max is saying, it doesn't really change anything, though? The relationship of forces internally in Turkey are still about the same. And Erdogan, while powerful, doesn't have unchecked or unmitigated or unlimited power. Anyway, what's your take on that?
I want to start by saying that there cannot be such a thing as unlimited power. It does not exist in the real world. Secondly, being legal and something being legitimate are two altogether different things. And all the problems, starting from 2002 up today, that Erdogan has faced so far has been with problems of legitimacy. He easily tackled legal problems. Laws can be changed, they can be written, they can be banned. All these can be done, but legitimacy problems are not that easy to tackle because you have to convince people that you are legitimate. Yes, women's movement, yes, Alevis, yes, workers, these people with their own problems see Erdogan as a source of their problems. With the economic problems now mounting, we have an accelerating inflation, a very speedily increasing exchange rate, and increasing interest rate at the same time. So this can only be mounting for workers, very hard living conditions for the next at least 2 years. And we cannot see right now how bad this will become in the next 3-4 months. So I think what will change the balance or constellation or whatever we can say about social power is the material relations between the bourgeoisie and the working class. With the economic crisis so apparent, which will diminish the power of middle classes in the economy and bring forth the contradiction between the working class and the bourgeoisie into the forefront as the main determinant of the ideology, politics, and so on and so forth, this will become more apparent under the conditions of economic crisis. Up to now, at least up to 6-7 months before now, most of the middle classes had reigned because the economy was more or less growing, money was abound, credit was abound, so everybody was more or less materially, let's not say happy, but subdued. Now, the material problems will become more prominent in people's lives.
Max, I want to ask you the same question. I mean, going back to a theme that you started with. Yes, as Nevzat said, no, there is no authority that has unlimited power, true enough. But in spite of all of the economic and social problems and the failures and catastrophes of Erdogan's international policy, nonetheless, he has a 52% majority. And I want to go to the question that Nevzat was also raising about legitimacy. Like, if you look here in the United States, half the population thinks that Donald Trump is completely illegitimate, completely, no matter what power he has. But there's another big part of the population, maybe not 50%, but probably 40%, that feels that he's completely legitimate. And so in terms of the trying to measure things on the scale of legitimacy, there's not a generic issue of legitimacy because it's in the eyes of the beholder. The question that really seems to sort of dominate is, does the existing political force, in our case, Trump, or in your case, Erdogan, have enough state or institutional power and enough backing within the population to pursue their policies? And if so, Erdogan seems to be embarked on a course of undoing the secular character of Turkish schools and of Turkish society, of snuffing out the opposition, or at least rendering it to be largely ineffective while engaging in a lot of repression. Just with those words in mind, where are we right now with Erdogan?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think that a direct comparison between the United States or, you know, given any other European country, Western country, and Turkey doesn't really work because of the particular history of Turkey. So, I mean, Nevzat would probably not agree fully with my assessment here, but there has never been a real bourgeois democratic revolution in Turkey with the people, the broad masses, as political actors. And there is an enormous long tradition of a despotic state, a very oppressive state in Turkey. So I think if you would ask the majority of Donald Trump opponents, they would probably say that they regard Donald Trump as illegitimate, an idiot, or whatever. But they would still cling to the notion that the United States is a great country, great democracy, or whatever. So Democrats at least would say that. And would just say a different government would put things in place. In Turkey, large swaths of the population are more and more moving away from the state as such, or have always been a distance from the state. That is the Kurdish population, parts of the Alevi population. Women don't expect anything from that state. So there has always been a much more difficult relation of state and society in Turkey. So I think that is a crucial difference that we have to take in mind. As far as the changes of Erdogan or of Erdogan's rule are concerned, yes, I mean, he is transforming the state. He is transforming, or under his rule, the state and society are transformed, and the relation of state and society are transformed, most certainly. None of the things that you described are new, but as a matter of fact, they are not new to Erdogan's rule either. Most of this started with the coup d'etat. There were tendencies before, but particularly with the coup d'etat in 1980, neoliberalism on the one hand, so the power relations shifting in favor of capital, and on the other hand, a conservative religious social program, social ideology, and the breaking of the power of the left in every regard, political, cultural, social, has been the central program of the Turkish state, first by military power, by direct military force, and this program has been continued under the rule of Erdogan, even though, obviously, it has also been transformed in some regards.
So, Max, we have a minute left. Real quick, what's your prognosis? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but what will Erdogan do immediately in the coming period with this sort of this victory that he's achieved at the polls?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a range of possibilities, and they're not so many. There's probably two or three general tendencies that are possible. One is that he's actually becoming, at least in the first place, more milder to consolidate this new victory. That is to say, he will seek large alliances beyond the camp that he has organized right now, also with all factions or within, or different factions within the state and factions of capital, obviously, especially to master the economic troubles ahead. Another scenario is obviously that he will become soft on some parts of society and very harsh in others, for example, seeking to navigate economic problems while being very harsh on the Kurdish movement. Another scenario is that he will be very harsh on all of us. And that means that there will be a much more aggressive Turkish state force against the population. I think it will largely play out within the realm of these three options. We will see how it goes. We will also see how, capital has reacted positive. The spokesperson of the big bourgeoisie said that now is the time for reforms, which means IMF type of austerity regimes, with the IMF or without, it doesn't matter. So they are kind of content with what happened here. At least they seek to do the best of it. And we will see what it means in terms of relation of state and society. That will also depend if there is resistance or not, on what kind of resistance.
We will indeed see what it means. We were joined from Istanbul by Nevzat İvrim Önal, a journalist with the Turkish newspaper Sol, and we were also joined from Istanbul by Max Zerngast. He's an independent journalist based in Ankara. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we kick off our weekly half-hour segment. It's every Monday, called Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Welcome back, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me back. It's been a big week.
It has been a big week. And guess what? Every week is a big week when it comes to technology, which is, of course, a dominating economy and also dominating society. And for all of us as individuals and for our families, also having such a huge impact. So we're very pleased, Chris, that we can start to use this as a weekly segment, 30 minutes where we take a look at the big stories. Let's start first with, we talked about it a little bit last week, but it's so big, and rarely is there some good news coming from this Supreme Court, but there was in this case. Go ahead.
Sure. So there was a ruling on Friday in the case of Carpenter v. United States. And to provide a little bit of background, Mr. Carpenter in 2011 was arrested in connection with a string of robberies at Radio Shack stores. But the way that he was arrested was that the police got his cell phone location information from cell phone companies based on the towers that his cell phone pinged when he was near them. And they decided that he was within, I believe it was a couple miles of each of these robberies and at the time they occurred, and therefore he was part of them. So we need to talk about how cell phones work, right? So we always have our cell phones on us. 95% of Americans have a cell phone, and I'm sure the vast majority always have them on and on you when you travel. In order to get a signal, those bars, the cell phone has to reach out and see which towers are close by. and see which towers are going to relay that phone call, you know, to or from your device, or that data to or from your device. And so this is metadata, right? This provides information to the cell phone company on where you are. And they do use this to track where service is good, where service is not so good, where there's a need for more towers or better service. But they also are collecting information that is personalized about where your individual phone is. Now, this has nothing to do with the GPS function on your phone. This is a completely separate thing about just what cell phone tower you're connecting to. And so the phone company gave this information to the police. Now, this decision in Carpenter is exciting, but not too exciting. I definitely got excited when I heard it, but when you read the decision, it's actually very limited in scope, but I hope it sets up good rulings in the future. So it was a 5-4 decision. Roberts wrote the majority opinion, that's Chief Justice Roberts, and then Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined in, and they agreed that the police should have gotten a warrant instead of just a court order. And there's a difference between the two, and that you need to prove a little more to get a warrant than you do just to get a court order in order to get that cell phone location information from the cell phone companies. One of the things that concerns me, though, is that this wasn't a broad decision. And in fact, one of the things in the decision is that they made this arbitrary distinction of 6 days of data, so that you just need a court order to get up to 6 days of cell phone location information from the company, but after six, you need to get a warrant. And they didn't provide any real reasoning for that. Now, that still would have helped Mr. Carpenter in this case because the robberies happened over the course of weeks, but it's not clear why they say 6 days.
I wondered about that, Chris. We're speaking with Chris Garafa from New Haven, Connecticut. He's a web developer and technologist. But Chris is doing a segment for us now weekly on technology. It's a 30-minute segment. Today's the first one. Chris, are there any other cases pending that are similar to this one? Because it seems like this issue comes up all the time. You know, we hear about the FBI trying to crack into Apple iPhones and Apple's standing up to them. Then we hear about Verizon turning everything over to the FBI with just a national security letter. So it seems to me like this is going to have to be decided and determined by the courts. So besides Carpenter versus United States, is there anything else that's pending that's important that we ought to be focused on?
You know, very often cases are brought in the courts, frequently in a district court, and they are turned down. Many of the cases, for example, get turned down on national security reasons. And I think that that's very important to acknowledge. And so they never even get to the Supreme Court. They never get heard because the state goes in, the state's attorney or the federal attorney goes in and says there's a national security exemption. We can't talk about this. And it's thrown out immediately. So unfortunately, there isn't a named case right now on this specific issue that I can bring up, but we should always be aware of where these cases, you know, which cases are going to the courts and in the details of why they're being turned down for national security reasons.
Chris, I want to go back to the basic explanation of how this works. Again, we just use, most people just use their phone. They don't really, maybe it's just older people don't know how their phones work. Maybe everybody else does, but let's assume that big parts of the population don't. If you have your phone with you, when you're passing, wherever you go, the companies are able to track you even if you're not making a call, right? Even if you're not receiving a call. What about if your phone is off?
So in most cases, you won't be tracked like that if your phone is off. We have seen that the CIA and the NSA do have the ability to make your phone seem like it's turned off, but actually is turned on. Now, if that's something you're concerned about, I would say leave your cell phone at home turned off as well.
Yeah, you can't take the battery out anymore.
Right, and yeah, with most of these new phones, iPhones in particular, you can't take the battery out. You have to, you know, pay to get it replaced by Apple. Even with taking the battery out, there are other smaller batteries in some of these phones to help you keep track of the time and so forth. So in general, Brian, I would say that, you know, if your phone is off, you are probably not going to be tracked, but there are cases that we know of where the NSA does or CIA is able to make your phone appear that it's off but actually it's on and tracking.
That would require them targeting a person, right?
Yes, they would have to target a person or a group of people. Another interesting thing that the Carpenter case doesn't address is the use of stingrays. Now, the stingray is a device that appears to your phone as a cell phone tower. So everything that your phone does is going through this device, and the government agency, whether it's police or whoever that's using it, can collect all of the voice and data and text and everything that's coming through your phone. And your phone doesn't know. It just looks and says, this is a cell phone tower, and connects to it. So Carpenter also doesn't address the issue of stingrays. And stingrays are often used at political protests and political events. We've seen them used at a number recently, including the G20 protests, the Baltimore uprising, and others.
Chris, keeping consistent with these technology issues, I want to switch just a little bit and talk about Google. Google admitted this week that early run units of its Home Mini speaker, these are preview units of something called the Home Mini speaker, secretly recorded conversations. This seems to be an ongoing theme with these devices, secretly recording conversations, sending them to people in your address book, maybe even sending them to the cops. Tell us about that.
Yeah, Google last week had actually said that this device that hasn't even been launched yet, it sent out some preview units to journalists and to their own employees to test, which is very very regular thing to do. You send things out for people to test them in the real world. But it turns out there was a bug that let these devices eavesdrop even when they hadn't been asked to start listening. The microphone effectively was always on. And in these devices, the HomePod, the Amazon Echo, the Google Home, these devices, the microphone actually is always on. And that's also true of your cell phone in most cases. The microphone is always on listening for that watchword, right? That phrase or word or name that you use to trigger the listening to listen to your command. Turns out it wasn't just listening for the command, it was listening to everything, and then sent them out to Google servers. Now, it's a scary thing. I don't think there was any, ill intent in this particular case. I think it was a bug, and it's good that it's going to be addressed. But the bottom line is these devices have always-on microphones, just like your cell phone does.
You know, my cell phone a couple of times has switched itself on. Well, not the phone on, but the Siri has switched itself on and has begun transcribing what I was saying. When I said the word seriously instead of Siri, it heard Siri, but I had said seriously.
If you had said mysteriously, that might have also done it. Yeah. Let's think of all the different variations.
Yeah, it's a problem. I had to go in and deactivate the doggone thing, so it stopped doing it.
Maybe we should apologize to all the people in the audience whose phones are going off right now.
That's right.
Oh, that's right. We did it. We could be triggering you if you're listening on your phone. Oh, my goodness. We are sorry. On behalf of the Loud and Clear team, we're sorry for activating your microphone right now.
Hey, can we switch to something that's been in the news like constantly for the last several weeks? Immigration. There's been a lot relative to technology that's been in the news. First of all, Microsoft employees have protested the company's deal with ICE, which I think is very cool. And secondarily, related to this Microsoft story, there was a piece in Gizmodo that I thought was fun. All kinds of tech companies are working with ICE. And we saw the same thing a decade ago when word got out that so many of these tech companies were working with the CIA secretly, clandestinely. And then later on, so many of the telecommunications companies were working with the CIA. Well, here we are all these years later, and it's ICE working with all of these companies.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, and this goes back so far. I mean, we know back from the breakup of the telecom companies that AT&T, even in the 80s, was working with the NSA to give them information. This is profit for these companies. It's profit for Microsoft. It's profit for Google. It's profit for Amazon. But I'm so excited by the fact that employees at these companies are standing up and they're protesting in their way the deals that and the work that their companies are having with the federal government and these awful programs, whether it's Google with the Project Maven and the missile or the drone technology the $19 million contract that Microsoft has with ICE, which is just one of its many government contracts. And we should say Amazon employees also recently put out a letter protesting to Jeff Bezos the work that Amazon does with the government, with the CIA, and with ICE. And I'm very excited by the fact that these things are happening. You know, technology often has been seen as a very sort of libertarian, individualist area of work. But I believe that given the movements that have really sprung up in the wake of the election, people are realizing how their individual work, how the companies they work for, and in fact, how the entire system contributes to oppressions. And so to see them coming together, these employees coming together at different companies, is such an exciting thing and it's such a positive thing. And I can only hope that they continue and that more of these employees do it. You know, Amazon employees in particular made a very direct connection to how IBM worked with the Nazis during the Holocaust. And IBM effectively proudly worked with them to make money in their U.S. offices and then in some European offices. And I think it's a very apt comparison. And the reason for that is that when the, you know, when the Nazis first came to power, they didn't immediately start concentration camps. They started keeping track of people. They started registries of Jewish people, of Roma people, of gay people, and so on. And that's effectively what Microsoft and Amazon are helping the federal government do now.
That's exactly right. And it's something that really hasn't been out there in a very public way, but I think is critically important. I want to switch again, too, and talk a little bit about the issue of facial recognition software. This is something that is now being introduced at Orlando Airport, which is frankly one of the busiest medium-sized airports in America, as you might imagine, with Disney World being there and other parks. And it's been done for years in London at Heathrow Airport and Gatwick Airport. It's, I think, a very dangerous thing as well. And to tell you the truth, as a former CIA officer, it's going to make it impossible for an officer to clandestinely cross borders under an assumed name. Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, so the story here is that for a while now, the Orlando International Airport, which is Florida's most active airport and one of the busiest in the country for international traffic, has already for a while been doing select facial identification for international passengers, particularly people coming from outside of the United States in and people getting onto international flights. Now they're going to be expanding this to every single international flight that comes in and out of Orlando International Airport. They say, again, it is only going to be for people who are not citizens of the United States. But my question would be, how do you guarantee that? How do you guarantee that the camera isn't catching somebody else's face? And also, why should anyone be surveilled in this way when they're coming into the country? You know, and this relates back to what we were just talking about. It's not clear which technology they're using in Orlando, but this is something that Amazon has actually been working on. Amazon has a program, and I think we've talked about it, called Recognition with a K. And it's a facial recognition and categorization system. And this is, it's such a scary thing because Amazon's web services are brilliant. They're fast. They expand widely. They're great technology. But for facial recognition, for this kind of technology, Amazon's web services are just going to enable this to be tracked faster and in many different ways. So it's a very scary thing. And I think we're going to start seeing it at many different locations and other airports.
Chris, I noticed in this piece on FoxNews.com that this technology is being used in New York, Boston, and Chicago to scan flyers on what they're saying are some outbound international flights. Do you see this technology expanding to a point where we're going to get to all airports, that we'll be doing all flights? Is this a permanent attack on our civil liberties or on our privacy at least?
Absolutely. The growing surveillance state and surveillance capitalism needs this information and it needs this profit. I don't see this stopping either at just airports. There was a story recently last week about customs agents boarding a bus in Maine, well past the Canadian border. What is going to prevent them from using facial recognition technology on passengers on these buses or on Amtrak or regional railroads? It is terrifying how many cameras there are out there. Next time you go out, look at how many cameras there are out there and see which information can we get? So it's not just about specific facial recognition technology in the cameras either, because using, for example, Google or Amazon developed technology, they can take any image and apply facial recognition to it.
I want to go back to the IBM story. IBM and the Nazis.
Yes.
You know, there's a book called IBM and the Holocaust, The Strategic Alliance Between Nazi Germany and America's Most Powerful Corporation. That was at that time. What IBM basically did was it went to Germany. Watson, who was then the CEO of IBM, went to Germany in October 1933. Of course, the Nazis took power. Hitler took power in January 33. By the springtime, they had set up close to Munich, a concentration camp of 60,000 political prisoners, mainly for leftists at that time. Watson went to Germany and increased the funding for IBM subsidiary to work with the Nazis in creating a long delayed census that the Nazis were eager to do in Germany. And the census was important for the Nazis because they wanted to identify Jews. And they wanted to identify Roma people, or what's known in popular sort of racist vernacular as gypsy people. And IBM knew exactly what they were doing. That this was not mysterious. And as the years unfolded, as the years developed, Watson continued, the IBM, this was the biggest corporation in America at that time, continued to work with the Nazis. I mean, this is a long sordid history of mega, you know, corporations, monopoly corporations, working with all kinds of state apparatuses. The NSA is not a Nazi organization, but if there was a political right-wing transition even further to the right of where we were, of course, then the NSA could conceivably be like a tool of the far, far, far right instead of just the right.
And do we trust NSA to withstand pressure from the far right? I don't, for one.
Yeah, and then you have the NSA also with religious and racial profiling of Arabs, Arab Americans, South Asians. In other words, the same sort of racial supremacist and racial stereotyping, which was typical of Nazis. I mean, that was the Nazi regime. And Nazism, by the way, the Hitler experiment largely relied on the way America had created and architected an apartheid system here in the United States. I mean, that's real. It's really quite remarkable, Chris. And actually, people don't know anything. I don't think they know anything about this history. Again, the name of the book is IBM and the Holocaust, The Strategic Alliance Between Nazi Germany and America's Most Powerful Corporation. Now, we've all learned to hate the Nazis, of course, because finally Germany fought the United States. And then the ruling elites in general went from being partial supporters or in some cases full supporters of Nazism to be the opponents of Nazism. But maybe not fundamentally, in terms of the totalitarian impulses of the current state system or of their foundational ideology. Anyway, that's my rant. Go ahead, Chris.
No, I think you're right on. And I highly recommend people who are interested in this read that book, IBM and the Holocaust, to understand how far this went and how far this goes. We often hear about the meticulous records that were kept by the Nazis, and it was IBM that enabled them to do that. And it was IBM that enabled their killing machine to be unfortunately so efficient. And we need to address this history and the histories in the United States as well with to understand how these companies, these private companies that are out just to make a profit, are going to or are already working with government agencies to facilitate mass oppression. Absolutely.
And the Holocaust, again, it didn't all happen in 1933.
It was a very long process.
And it happened even as it moved forward for bureaucratic reasons. You know, men who were enslaved in Nazi labor operations. Well, what to do with their elderly parents who nobody could take care of them? Well, the simple solution was kill them. In other words, there was a lot of bureaucratic incremental steps on the part of Nazism. My point being that when you have aggregated power by racist state organizations that have the capacity to carry out complete surveillance of their populations, there's no reason to think that this doesn't pose a fundamental danger to society and to individuals, and as we say about this segment, cherished freedoms.
That's absolutely right. And the more we talk about this, the more the employees of these companies themselves are speaking out about this, the more people will be aware and the more people will be able to put pressure, not just on these companies, but on the government agencies and the government representatives themselves to enable this. And that's the only way we're going to defend our civil liberties, is by standing up and saying, we have these rights. You are not going to take them. And in fact, we are going to strengthen them. And it's going to take movements. It's going to take a struggle, but I believe that we are doing it and we can continue to do it. And I think Carpenter was just one small example. The Carpenter ruling is one small example of where this is going to go.
Chris, the New York Times ran a piece this week too that you've highlighted to us. It's entitled "What 7 Creepy Patents Reveal About Facebook," and it is creepy. Can you talk about that?
Oh yeah, I saw this this morning, and I said we had to talk about this. These are just 7 of the thousands and thousands of patents that Facebook has applied for. Just one of them: classifying your personality depending on what news stories you interact with, what ads you interact with, which ones you just look at for longer, what you're posting, your private messages. They're going to try to classify your personality and use that information at the very least to sell you different types of ads. They're going to, one of the scariest ones is identifying your camera. You know, we've all scratched the camera on our phone. Maybe there's a little piece of dust on it. And they're going to use those micro details from your camera so that if I take a picture with my phone, John, and send it to you, and then you post it to Facebook, they can tell that it actually came from my phone because I've posted other things to Facebook from my own phone with that same camera. Now, that just screams privacy violation to me, in particular when you think about how Facebook is going to give that information to law enforcement. Facebook already tracks faces, so they do automatic facial recognition and say, hey, we found your friends in this photo, can we tag them? But even if you say no, they still have that information. Now they're going to be able to tell who took a photo, even if it's not from your own device. It's terrifying to me. Speaking of microphones, they're going to listen to your environment, or maybe they already are. We don't know. They're going to be able to identify when you're using the Facebook app, if you're watching TV and what you're watching and which ads you skip or which ads you pay attention to, whether you've muted them or not. And of course, then they're going to go through and tailor your advertisements based on that as well. These are just a few of these. And they are terrifying. Somebody actually came up with these. And I want to know why some employee thought this was a good idea, other than to make money. And of course, that's the only reason they would need to do this, is to make a profit from what should be our private data.
One of the things I was really disappointed with that I saw in this article was that one of the things that Facebook is doing is they're looking at your posts and the messages that you send to judge your degree of extroversion, openness, and emotional stability, right? And then it uses that, whatever the algorithm tells it, to select which news stories you should see and which ads should be targeted at you. I think that's just absolutely awful.
It's incredible. I mean, and everybody uses Facebook because you create an online community, or you want to communicate a message. You want to stay in touch with family and friends. Like, we're allowed to swim in this little pool,
yeah.
But the whole thing is stage managed.
The cost is very high.
It is high. It is high. And people I think what they assume is that this is fundamentally benign, at least for them.
Yes.
Since they're not engaged in bad things. They're not involved in terrorism. They have no reason to really hide. So, you know, they enjoy the benefit of being online using Facebook. But in fact, we don't know what the consequences are, because this is they know everything. Those companies, those private capitalist profit-making corporations, they know everything about us.
Before we leave, and we're going to have to leave, we have just about a minute left. I want to ask Chris to give us this. We want to have you give us a tech tip every week. And this week we wanted to ask about passwords, how to choose a strong password that you can still remember.
The best password you can use is a very long password. It used to be people would, you know, replace an A with an at sign or add an exclamation point at the end of a short password. That just makes it harder for you to remember. It doesn't make it harder for a computer program to guess. So the best password you can have is maybe string 4 or 5 words together and do it in a way that you can remember what those words are. The longer a password is, the longer it takes for a computer program going through thousands or millions of tries per second to guess what that password is. So that's what I would recommend, as long as possible, for your passwords.
Our final question is, Chris, is what's your password? No, I'm joking. We don't want your password.
We don't have time to even get to it. It's that long.
It's that long. All right. That's all the time we have. This has been the beginning of our weekly half-hour segment on Loud and Clear called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We've been joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.